You're listening to My Radio at StanPelke.com.
Thanks for tuning in. This is Maddie Pelke, your host for today's 8th podcast featuring readings from my dad's original novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. Today's program brings Chapter 4 to its conclusion. Please check back regularly for more episodes, including a special upcoming bonus podcast featuring original music from the first 4 chapters.
Charlie Spear had ended up following Gloria Jane back to Albany at the end of the summer, and he had enrolled at Union College in nearby Schenectady. Classes had started in early September, and the semester went quite well for Charlie. He had never realized before how much he liked science until he began to take his introductory college biology lab course. His math and English courses went very well, too. He'd even managed to get some work thanks to Gloria Jane's father. And of course, he was seeing as much of Gloria Jane as their busy academic schedules allowed. She had enrolled in a teacher training certificate program and was busy learning the latest theories about training children correctly. Her father had told her that studying math full-time could wait until after the Depression. Life had become almost idyllic. And then, on Monday, November 16, 1936, Charlie received an urgent telegram from Widow Jackson. Grandpa had been taken ill and was in the county hospital. "What's wrong, Charlie?" Gloria Jane asked him as they met up for a late supper that evening. "Grandpa, I got a telegram. He's sick. I've got to go home. Can't Widow Jackson take care of things for a few weeks so you can finish up the term? I don't know. That's a lot to ask. Maybe we can both go up this weekend. I can help you sort things out." "Yeah, maybe." Charlie decided to wait, like Gloria Jane had suggested, but his mind was terribly unsettled. In the end, he did not make it to Saturday. Thursday night, Charlie boarded a bus for Malone. He never returned to Union College or Schenectady. For 3 exhausting and frustrating years, Charlie tried to be the man of the house on the family farm in Malone. His grandfather had had a stroke and never walked well enough again to be able to do much around the farm. He grew increasingly thin, increasingly despondent, and increasingly bitter at the turn of events in his own and Charlie's lives. "Grandpa, it's all right. Everything will turn out fine in the end," Charlie would say often in the evenings. But the old man would just cluck his tongue or curse or even break down in tears. Eventually, Charlie and his grandfather simply stopped talking about anything important, except when Charlie needed advice about his work on the farm. But if his grandfather's success on the old land had been limited, Charlie's was even more so. Each month, each year, the bills mounted, even as the Depression lingered on and on. They took in boarders. Sherman had already been living with them. Keeping Sherman sober was one thing Grandpa Spear could still do. But Sherman was even less of a farmer than Charlie, and while his help on the farm in 1936 and 1937 had been appreciated, it added very little and did almost nothing to ameliorate the family's precarious financial position. One evening in July 1937, after Charlie and his grandpa had argued about the finances, Sherman volunteered to give up his room in the old farmhouse so they could rent it out.
"That's the kindest thing you've ever said, boy, and I much appreciate it," Grandpa had said, offering Sherman his hand. They rented his room the next day. For the next year, Sherman slept on a tiny cot near the old wood stove in the kitchen. Still, their income worsened. Charlie finally gave up his room, too, and they took in more boarders, Fred and Thea Smythe, a young couple from Burke. He worked off and on for the New York Central Railroad. She began to do the cooking for the household. Charlie joined Sherman in the kitchen on another old cot. The added income was simply more important than privacy or a room to call his own. That winter, Charlie had even gone back to work for Mr. Clayton,
but they were only just making it. In February 1938, Grandpa finally agreed with Charlie. They had to sell off 40 of the family's 100 acres so that they could eliminate most of the debts that had accumulated for the past decade. They sold another 20 acres in April 1939. Grandpa Spear urged Charlie to use the money to open a small shop of some sort so that he could begin to move away from dependence on the old farm. Charlie banked the money instead for an even rainier day and worked at the farm even harder. Sherman spent most days now working beside Charlie, sweating and cursing and praying silently that the next day would be better, but it never was. Grandpa Spear rallied briefly that summer. He even found a way to work for a few hours each week in the front vegetable garden. The economy finally had begun to improve, and the awful unemployment rates of the past few years began to turn back. And then Gloria Jane had arrived unexpectedly at the old farmhouse, and the summer only seemed to get better. She stayed with her cousins for 3 weeks, but she spent each day with Charlie and Grandpa. And then at the end of the 3 weeks, Grandpa Spear had another stroke. "Charlie boy," Grandpa whispered, reaching for his young man from his bed and urging him closer. "Grandpa," Charlie knelt beside him.
"There won't be much left after paying more medical bills. Let the farm go, son. Sell what's left. Take the money. Marry that beautiful Gloria Jane and get out of here."
"Not yet, Grandpa. Soon." Grandpa Spear lingered on until December 17th, 1939. The wake was over. Most guests had gone home. Sherman was trying to be useful, building evening fires back up and trying to comfort Grandpa Spear's small group of aged friends who had come to pay their respects. Widow Jackson was sitting quietly with Grandpa Spear's youngest sister, Aunt Florence, who was sobbing quietly. December 19th was a bitterly cold day, and the dark evening was even worse. Gloria Jane's aunt and uncle had already left, but she had wanted to stay on to be with Charlie a little bit longer. Charlie had caught Gloria Jane's eye and motioned for her to join him in the foyer. "I need to get out of the house for a few minutes and clear my head. Maybe we can head down to the pond at Miller's Bend. It should be just about frozen over and look beautiful tonight." "Okay, Charlie." Gloria Jane bundled up in her lovely fur-collared winter coat, drew on leather gloves, and put on her scarf. Charlie pulled on his heaviest sweater, then his pea coat and a hat. He stuffed his hands in his pockets, but let Gloria Jane snuggle up close and put her right arm through his left. They walked out into the crisp night air. Every star was ablaze in the heavens. They were both shivering, despite the layers of wool in which they had encased themselves, and despite the warm glow each felt in the other's presence. It had been too long since he had been next to her, too long since he had touched her, even if he could only touch her now through thick woolen garments. "Gloria Jane." How could he say the things that needed to be said? He had virtually nothing to give her, nothing to show for the 3 years he had spent since coming home from Schenectady. The farm had been chipped away. He'd sold the last of the fields to pay for Grandpa's burial and to give him just enough money to get away from that place. Gloria Jane pressed in even closer to him. "You know I love you, Charlie. What do you want to ask me?" "I'm not sure if you'll want to. I have so little to offer you right now." "You'll never know until you ask. You deserve more than the life of a poor man's wife."
"Says who, Charlie Spear?"
"I wanted to be more than a poor farmer, and now I don't even have the farm. I wanted to see the world, maybe move to the city and do something, be something." "Who says you won't? You're still studying, reading, working hard. I'm near finished with my teaching certificate. Who says we can't do more or be more?"
He leaned over and kissed her cheek.
"I know, love. But when? I don't want to lose you. How long can you wait for me?" She stopped and turned to look directly in his eyes. "Charlie Spear, if you will wait for me, I will wait for you." And she rose up on her toes and kissed him tenderly on the lips. It was the sweetest kiss he could remember.
The sound was horrific. Charlie had just enough time to glance up and see the automobile sliding toward them. Some idiot had driven too fast down Miller's Bend, had lost control on the ice, and flipped the car. It was now sliding at them at unbelievable speeds.
Without thinking, he pushed Gloria Jane aside, then tumbled after her, landing with his hip squarely on a rock that was protruding from the ground on the side of the road. The car slid by them, just inches away, and stopped, teetering on the edge of the pond, its front end dangling dangerously 3 feet above the icy surface. "Oh my God," Gloria Jane yelled. "Charlie, there's a little girl inside." As he collected his wits, Charlie saw that the driver had been knocked cold, but there was a little girl in the front seat, twisted in a heap against her father's inert body, and she was crying. As Charlie stumbled up, gasping in pain from the bashing of his hip, and hobbled toward the car, he could see that the man's head had been cut terribly by broken glass and was bleeding profusely. The little girl was also banged and bruised and bleeding. Uncertain what to do at first, Charlie finally decided to try to climb up onto the side of the car to open the passenger door. He was managing fairly well, balancing carefully so as not to rock the car too far forward, when another window burst and the car tilted another few degrees toward the pond's surface. "Be careful, Charlie!" Gloria Jane was visibly shivering from cold and anxiety. Re-establishing his equilibrium, Charlie carefully opened the door and reached into the car toward the little girl. "Can you give me your hand?" he called down to the little girl. "Can you give me your hand, sweetheart, so I can pull you up?" And then more urgently, "Come on, sweetie, you have to try." Somehow he'd managed to extract her from the car without more injury, but the effort set the car tilting even further toward the ice. Charlie helped the little girl scramble down the side of the vehicle, and then he slid off himself. Gloria Jane ran forward and pulled them both away from the wreck. She then wrapped her coat around the little girl and wiped her tears. "Everything's going to be okay," Gloria Jane assured the little girl. "Help my papa," she sobbed. "Please help him." "Go back to the house and send Sherman down here to help me," Charlie ordered Gloria Jane. "Take the little girl with you. She needs to get out of this cold air." "You're freezing too, Charlie. You can't stay out here, and your leg is hurt." "I'll be fine. Please go back to the house and send Sherman to help me. Sooner you send him down, sooner I can get my leg checked." Gloria Jane nodded, but took her scarf off and wrapped it around Charlie's neck and ears. "Don't try to get him out on your own." And with that, she started back toward Charlie's house, assuring the little girl all the way that they would get help for her father. The weight was unbearable. The car creaked and groaned. Still, the driver remained unconscious, despite Charlie's efforts to wake him. He dared not touch the car now. It had slid even further, and its front bumper was resting against ice. "Come on, come on, come on," he grumbled as he paced. "Come on, Sherm," he yelled into the night. The cold air was making the pain in his hip grow even worse. And then the sound he dreaded. The ice began to crack. "No, no, 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 no." Charlie hobbled back into the road and looked west. No sign of Sherman or anyone else approaching. He stumbled back to the car just as the ice gave way and the car began to slide down the edge through the ice and into the water. "No, no, 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 no!" Charlie grabbed the rear bumper. The metal was frightfully cold on his bare hands, but he held on. "Dear Lord, help me!" he yelled into the bitter night air. Of course, there was nothing he could do to stop the slow descent of the car through the icy surface. The interior was already filling with water, and even if Charlie had had the strength to counter the weight of the car's metal frame and arrest its dreadful slide into the moonlit icy water, he could not overcome the increasing burden of the water's weight. The horribly cold water finally shocked the wounded driver back into consciousness. At the last possible moment, he groaned and came to. When the terrible reality of his situation dawned on him, he screamed for help and began to claw at the door and the broken window. Charlie pulled and pulled, but the car jerked forward as its entire front half submerged. The screams of the driver disappeared into the cold darkness. The car jerked forward again. Charlie lost his hold, fell forward into the snow, and watched helplessly as the last inches of the car slid below the surface, and he wept bitterly. Charlie barely heard the sound of footsteps as Sherman hurried up to him and came to a sudden halt at the edge of the pond. Charlie finally looked up at his best friend and through tear-filled eyes, he mumbled, "What took you so long?" "I know where Sherman is," Charlie suddenly said. As the words poured out of his mouth, he realized he had spoken them out loud, and the sound of his own voice and the realization that he had spoken pulled him back into the present moment. Without even asking Chip or consulting Nurse Betty, Charlie began pushing Chip and his chair toward the rear of the lobby, toward the train platforms and the core of his nightmare.
"Whoa, wait a minute, Charlie, what's up?"
But Corporal Charlie Spear did not answer. He rushed past nurses and several doctors and headed toward the platforms, toward what had become the temporary morgue.
"Wait a moment, son," his doctor called. "You don't want to go back there. Nurse, stop them."
The red-haired nurse tried to grab his arm, but Charlie, with Chip, whisked past her. He was unstoppable now, and in a final burst of energy, Charlie pushed through the canvas curtains that had been set up across the entranceway to the platforms. The sight beyond was almost too much to bear, and all the good feelings that had grown in his heart and mind since reading Gloria Jane's letter vanished. Scores of dead soldiers, most carefully wrapped in sheets or woolen army blankets, lay neatly along the two platforms to the right. Their bloodied uniforms and boots were heaped unceremoniously on the leftmost platform. No trains here. Wooden carts that would eventually be hitched to horses were waiting for loading. Charlie pulled the wheelchair to a stop and walked on without Chip.
"Wait a moment, Charlie."
Chip began to wheel himself along behind Charlie. It was too much to bear or believe, but there, on the edge of the platform, at the very place where he had dreamed so many times that he had fallen off and onto the tracks. No, not onto the tracks, but into some unfathomable cosmic emptiness. There lay the shattered remains of Sherman Livernoise. Portions of the left side of his body, including part of his skull, had been blown away. What remained was a bloody wreck. Charlie fell to his knees and began to sob. His mouth filled with saliva, which began to trickle down his chin. Tears fell down his cheeks and snot filled his nose. It was simply too much to believe or bear. In his agony, Charlie tried to speak, but words would not form. He just gasped and moaned. Chip pulled up alongside him.
"I'm so sorry,"
he whispered. And then something caught Charlie's attention. Some 50 feet away, a woman in dark clothing moved out of the shadows and knelt beside one of the soldier corpses. How she had not seen or heard Charlie's approach was inexplicable. But as she knelt, she pulled a small, glowing object from a satchel slung across her back and began to move it carefully across the torso of the corpse, which started to shimmer with a peculiar orange hue. A wave of nausea swept over Charlie and his head began to swim. He had all he could do to grab hold of Chip's wheelchair to steady himself before he fell over completely. "I've seen that before," he gasped. Chip turned and looked in the direction of the woman.
"Hey, what are you doing?"
Chip's shouting finally caught her attention. The woman rose, straightened her back, and stared at the two troopers. Then, with an unbelievable quickness, she drew a small pistol from a holster on her hip and aimed it at Charlie and Chip.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa, easy, don't shoot. We're not armed."
There was a commotion behind them as the doctor and Nurse Betty pushed through the canvas curtains. For a split second, Charlie and Chip turned to look at them. When they turned back, the strange woman was gone. Charlie heaved, missed Chip's feet, but was sick all over the platform in front of them.
"Nurse, get these men out of here," the doctor barked.
But he, too, was clearly distracted by the sudden disappearance of the black-garbed woman. As Betty wheeled Chip away and drew Charlie after her with soft words of comfort, Charlie's mind exploded with pain and confusion. His eyes saw the canvas curtain close around him. His nose recognized the smell of the morgue behind him and the makeshift ward into which he was now moving. But his mind saw a small country hospital where, over 4 years earlier, he had returned on the morning after his grandpa died. He had followed a nurse into the small morgue and heard her say, "Excuse me, what are you doing here?" Charlie had looked over her shoulder and toward his grandfather's inert body, just in time to see a dark-garbed man stuff a small glowing object back into a satchel slung across his back. "How did I forget something like that until now?" he finally stammered between his sobs. "What did you say, sweetie?" Nurse Betty asked him. Charlie ignored her question and instead grabbed the doctor's arm as the older man slipped through the canvas curtain. "Who was that?" Charlie demanded.
"Not right now, Corporal. Nurse, get these men back to their beds."
Charlie Spear woke with a start. That second night in the train station should have been more peaceful. The fighting to the east had ended, and the newly wounded brought in after dinner had been tended to. Most were now resting quietly. Yet Charlie kept waking up every few minutes. The image of the black-dressed woman studying one of his slain comrades, and the image of the black-dressed man standing over his grandfather's silent form, were never far from his restless thoughts. He was about to turn over to try to fall back asleep once more when a pale, greenish light caught his attention off to the right, in the deep shadows. He could just make out a group of four people bending over several men. Charlie recognized one of the group as one of the attending doctors, though not the one who had been caring for him. There was also a nurse whom he did not recognize. The other two were perplexing. One was dressed in what looked like surgical gown and apron. He held a small device that was giving off the pale glow. The other was dressed all in black and was wearing the helmet of his spectral emesis. "I'm dreaming again," Charlie thought. "I have to be dreaming." Charlie dared not move. Yet if he were not dreaming, he certainly should not be seeing this, or be seen seeing this. But it was no use. He was transfixed and could not look away. As he watched, the strange orange hue he had seen earlier in the afternoon took shape in first one and then another of the wounded men's chests. "I must be asleep. I must be asleep. I must be asleep," he whispered over and over to himself. But he knew that he wasn't. "Lie down, Charlie. Lie down and look away," he silently urged himself. A soldier near him began to cough, and the group turned as one to look in Charlie's direction. They all could see him sitting up in bed, staring back at them. But no one said a word. No one did a thing. They all just looked and looked some more. And then Charlie Spear finally lay down on his pillow and begged anyone who might be listening to just help him to fall back asleep. In the final moments of wakefulness, he squeezed Gloria Jane's letter tightly against his chest. This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.